Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Nick Simmons, the Olympic athlete turned entrepreneur and founder of Run Gum, a line of caffeine-infused chewing gum that's sold in over 15,000 stores worldwide. Growing up in the small town of Boise, Idaho, Nick always had an affinity for the outdoors. He was an Eagle Scout that spent his weekends hiking, climbing, fishing, and camping with friends and family. Until one fateful day when he decided to try out for his high school's track and field team with hopes of impressing his crush that was a runner on the team already. It wasn't long before Nick realized he had a very natural ability and quickly progressed to winning his high school state championships in four different running events. Nick went on to study biochemistry in college as a student athlete, where he continued winning titles and championships left and right throughout the next few years. Toward the end of college, Nick made a conscious decision to go full force into being the best athlete he could possibly be. That's when he moved to Mexico for a summer, trained at 9,000 feet in elevation with a team of Kenyan runners, and came back to the U.S. as the country's number two ranked runner in the 800-meter event. This led to an Olympic qualification where Nick would go on to participate in the 2008 and 2012 games, placing as high as fifth among the best runners in the world. It was after his last Olympic performance that Nick decided to retire from running and launch Run Gum. In this episode, Nick and I talk about how he transformed a little bit of natural ability into a monumental training regimen, winning habits and level of discipline that led him to becoming one of the world's top runners. We explore the origins of Run Gum, the company he co-founded as a side business with his longtime running coach out of his garage at home. We dive into the strategies Nick and his team have used to grow Run Gum into a multi-million dollar side business and brand with products now carried in retailers like Target, CVS, REI, and more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Nick Simmons. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much. Honored to be here.
Man, the pleasure is all mine. We've got a lot of ground to cover today, so I want to start from the beginning with you. Sure. Where are you originally from?
I was born in Blytheville, Arkansas on an Air Force base. My dad was a surgeon in the Air Force, but I was actually raised from the ages of 3 to 18 in Boise, Idaho. So that's what I call home, and that's where my family's still at.
Man. Boise's beautiful. I've been through there, probably like 6 or 7 years ago. But from what I remember, love it.
We used to call it the best kept secret, but the secret's out. It's one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. right now for a reason.
Yeah, for good reason. It is beautiful. And I'm guessing that's also kind of where you got your initial jump start into becoming kind of an outdoors guy. Fishing, hiking, climbing. I've seen a lot of outdoor stuff on your feed.
Yeah. You know, my dad was an Eagle Scout and was really into outdoors, and I'm an Eagle Scout. And just growing up in Idaho, you know, you go 20 miles in any direction and you're in the wilderness. And so I was into biking and swimming and fishing and, you know, you name it. If it was outdoors, I was doing it from a pretty early age. And that kind of really stuck with me, not just from a physical fitness standpoint, but kind of a spiritual standpoint. I feel most connected to something bigger than me when I'm, you know, catching a fish or shredding down a big mountain. You know, I just really am drawn to that, the outdoors and everything that it offers.
I love that. At what age did running enter the picture for you?
I was pretty active from, like I said, an early age. I got into, you know, youth soccer and specifically into like kind of that more elite traveling stuff that's so horrible on parents early on. And it wasn't until eighth grade that I decided to go out for the cross country team, which was my first experience with like competitive running. And I really only did that because I had a crush on a girl and she said she was going out for the cross country team and the practices happened to be co-ed. So to spend more time with her, I joined the cross country team and the rest is history. She actually likes to take credit for my entire running career because I probably maybe wouldn't have gotten into it without a little push from her. So that was eighth grade. I ran cross all 4 years in high school and track sophomore through senior year in high school as well.
Man, that is hilarious. You can credit her for sending you down that path originally.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, track chose me, right? I think that anyone that makes an Olympic team obviously has a genetic gift. You can't ignore the genetic factor. But I also was a hard worker from an early age on. And the combination of speed and hard work tends to produce good runners. And good runners are drawn to track and field for obvious reasons. I loved that it was a sport that paid me dividends. The harder I worked, the more sacrifice and dedication I showed, the better I would run on the weekends. And it was just this, you know, self-feeding cycle. I worked hard, so I ran faster. So I got these, you know, pats on the back and congratulations. So I worked harder and ran faster. And I just kept doing that for 20 years until I found my way onto a couple of Olympic teams.
Yeah. Well, I love that you explain it as kind of this virtuous cycle of, you know, genetics, yes, playing some part in it, right? Like, so you have some natural skill, some natural ability, but that's not everything, right? Like you have to work really, really hard. That's been a common theme I've heard from everyone that I've talked to who's a professional athlete is that, you know, no one just lands on the basketball court in the NBA or finds himself walking onto the football field in the NFL. Like the same thing is true with running, right? Like it takes a ton of hard work, dedication. How do you look at kind of, you know, there's a lot of talk about the difference between kind of like discipline, habit, and on one side, and then motivation on the other. How do you look at kind of the balance between that discipline, that habit versus say motivation? What drives you?
It's a really good question. And you're going to need to have, you know, a certain amount of points in each category. I know some people that are just so disciplined, like they're actually too disciplined, if you can believe that. To the point that they actually burn out very quickly, you know, and then there's motivation, and motivation's a tough one because every athlete, you know, beats to a different drum. There's different motivators. When I was a young pro, my motivator was to impress girls. Like that's why I did it, you know, and that's obviously not my primary motivator now at the age of 35. So I think that motivation comes from a lot of different places, but every single person that you see on an Olympic team is going to have just an absurdly impressive work ethic in some ways. They might not be the best, you know, at a 9-to-5, but they have a great work ethic when it comes to working out and managing their careers. And they also have an underlying motivator that gets them out of bed when they don't want to work out. And like I said, my motivators have been money. It has been adulation. It has been self-fulfillment. All of those have been the key driving motivator at different points in my career. But there has to be an underlying thread when you don't want to go for that evening run. You already ran 10 miles in the morning and your coach says you got to go for another 4-mile run. There has to be something driving that. It has to be more than just something that's very transient.
I love it. All right. So after winning the high school state championships in a few individual races, you go on to college at Willamette, which I'm actually not super familiar with aside from knowing that it's a pretty old and very small school. I'm assuming you had a lot of options for athletic scholarships at the time. So why did you choose Willamette?
Hey, great question. I actually didn't have a lot of options. So,
I was
what you would call a late bloomer. I got into running partially because I was the smallest kid in my high school when I started out. Male or female, I weighed 90 pounds. I was about 5 feet tall. And even though I loved ice hockey and soccer, those kind of weren't options for me. So another reason why I kind of gravitated towards running is that, you know, the bigger kids couldn't hit me. And that late blooming didn't work out real well when you're looking at colleges because I didn't really post good times until my early 20s. And at that point I'd already committed to Willamette. And so I went to Willamette because I wanted to be a student athlete. And if I was going to pay for college, or rather my folks were going to foot the bill, I wanted to find the program that was going to help me accomplish my goals. And my goals were to run and have fun running, but that was really a secondary goal compared to the academic goals that I'd set for myself. I wanted to be a doctor. I would have been a fourth generation surgeon. And so I went to the school where I felt that I had the best chance of getting into medical school. And Willamette was just minting doctors. I mean, everyone that went through their biochemistry track was either going on to get a PhD or an MD. And so I went to Willamette really with the primary focus of getting a biochemistry degree and running on the side. And it just so happened that going into my senior year, I decided to switch those priorities and make running my number one priority. And that's really what launched my pro career.
Did you still graduate from Willamette with your biochemistry degree?
I did. I actually, you know, I went from being like a 3.8 student to a 2.5 student my senior year, which I knew was a risk. Yeah, I knew it was a risk, but I knew that there's only so many hours in the day for a student athlete, and you're either a student athlete or you're an athlete student. And I made a conscious decision my senior year to be an athlete student, knowing that I could go back and retake the classes if I needed to. But I felt it in my gut that there was this untapped potential in my legs if I could just put the hours and the energy into training and living like a pro. And so that's really what I did. I blew off a lot of classes and my professors were all worried about me. And I even said, I'm not even going to take the MCATs, which I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I moved to Mexico between my junior and senior year, lived at 9,000 feet and trained with a bunch of Kenyans. And I shed 25 pounds and came back just an absolute running machine. I went from being ranked 50th in the United States in the 800 to being ranked number two. And I had Nike offer me a pro contract. And so the day I graduated college, I actually, you know, went into managing the Nick Simmons brand and building out, you know, this brand that carries on to today. And of course, signing my first pro contract.
Yeah, turned out to be a good decision for you. Who would have thought ditching med school would pan out so well?
Well, and it was risky. I'm not saying that every student athlete should do that. I think it's a huge, huge risk. But it, you know, when, if we're going to take risks, when else are we going to do it than in our, you know, when we're young? I don't know if I would have the guts to take that kind of risk at 35. But at 21, I thought it was more risky not to find out what my potential was than to continue the status quo, which wasn't necessarily making me happy.
And I think it's really important too to highlight to everyone listening that you were investing a crazy amount in yourself for the years leading up to this, right? It wasn't like just this decision, this split decision you made one day, like, hey, I don't really feel like doing this anymore. Let me try this other thing. It's like, you have been building up a crazy amount of momentum towards this.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you're starting to branch out, when you're saying, hey, I've been down this path, but I'm seeing other paths presenting themselves ahead of me. You don't just blindly run down a path. You take a second to stop and look at the map and say, okay, does this path have potential? Is it going over a cliff or does it really have legs to take me somewhere incredible? And I saw that running had potential. I had been doing it for nearly a decade. I had been improving every single year like clockwork. I was winning and I thought if I invest, and this is another one, and more importantly, I hadn't been investing myself 100% into it. I had only kind of been, you know, I hate to use the term, but half-assing it through college. I'm like, if I full-assed it, how good could I be? And so I did. I went all in on running, but it was only with great data that I had the guts to do so.
That's really smart. So, you know, you mentioned between your junior and senior year training at elevation in Mexico, 9,000 feet, a handful of titles, championships later, you find yourself training for the Olympics in the lead up to the 2008 games in Beijing. What was that period of time like for you?
You know, it goes down as some of the greatest days of my life. I had always kind of resented running and academics because I always saw them for me personally as mutually exclusive. I couldn't be a great doctor because I had running competing for my time and attention. I couldn't be a great runner because I was always stuck in class. So then when I graduate and I sign this pro contract and I look at my daily schedule and literally all I have to do during my waking conscious hours is get my workout in, I fell in love with running. I'm like, this is amazing. Like every day I wake up, I get to go run with my friends and I'm outside and this is so cool. And those first 2 years, as I was just 100% all in on trying to be an Olympian, I had purpose, I had focus, I had time, I had energy, I had resources. I truly had the wonderful experience of seeing just how good I could be if I went all in on one thing.
How did you finish in those first games that you competed in?
I won the Olympic trials. I was ranked number one as far as Americans were. I was our best chance at winning a medal. But I was young, you know, 24, and my first real major international competition, I was inexperienced, and I bombed out in the semis, which was a really hard blow to my ego and just tough to swallow. But it gave me this sense of, hey, how if I got this good with going in all in for 2 years, how good could I be 4 years from now? And so I signed another 4-year deal with Nike and committed to training for the 2012 games, knowing that I'd be more mature, wiser, stronger when I approached those games. And ultimately I made the finals in 2012.
Yeah. So I saw in my research leading up to this, you placed fifth, in the 800 meter event.
Yeah. And that's another bittersweet story is that I ran a time that would have, thank you very much, but I ran a time that would have won an Olympic medal in every single other Olympic game. And actually the Olympic gold in almost every single other Olympic games. That happened to be kind of a freaky race where David Rudisha, the current world record holder, ran the world record in the Olympic final. And so we all just got towed to these insane times. So on the one hand, I'm so honored to have been a part of it. But on the other, I'm like, man, I could have won a medal in almost any other games. But, you know, there are things that we can control as athletes and there are things we can't. And what my competition does, I can't control. I could control my training and how I approached that race. And I brought the best product that I've ever brought in a race, in a competition, in the Super Bowl of track and field. So, you know, I look back on that with fond memories and a huge sense of pride for what I was able to accomplish.
Yeah, pride is the word that comes to mind for me too. And then, you know, speaking to what you said, the next year you go on to win the silver in the 2013 World Championships, which is incredible.
Thank you.
My gosh, do you still have your eyes on Olympic medals these days, or are we
slowing? You know, I'm slowing down, unfortunately. The average age in my event, the 800, was about 24, 25 years old. So I ran professionally in that event till I was 33. And people would look at me like, how are you still doing this? And I would look down at my poor legs and I'm like, honestly, I'm on, you know, fumes at this point. So the day before I turned 34, I retired. And last year, I was 34 last year, 2018. It was a very transformative year for me, a very challenging year in a lot of ways. When you make, you know, athletics your primary reason for being, when you define yourself first and foremost as an athlete, and then you lose that, it can be very difficult emotionally. And that's why a lot of Olympians go through really deep depressions after the games. And, you know, I had worked hard on an exit strategy. I had a wonderful girlfriend at the time. I had a business that was flourishing. And I still found it really difficult to say goodbye to that, you know, driving force. And so last year was a real transformative year for me. This year, I would say 35 is, so far, I'm halfway through it, is emerging as the greatest year of my life for a lot of reasons. So I've really found my calling as a businessman. I recently got engaged, and I just feel this sense of purpose that I didn't feel last year that I'm starting to feel again, kind of what I felt when I was running, but in a different way.
Yeah, let's talk about some of that newfound purpose. So RunGum is your company. You officially started working on the formula for your first line of caffeine-infused chewing gum back in 2014 with your coach, Sam,
Correct. Correct. Yeah, and I was, you know, no surprise here, when you're a pro athlete and when you're making Olympic teams, you have all these energy drinks companies sending you their product, and I was drinking them all, and I love energy drinks, but my stomach doesn't, you know, and most athletes don't want to be forced to drink a big, heavy, acidic liquid before they work out. And so I used that biochemistry degree I had. I said, let's just take the stimulants out of the energy drink and infuse it into chewing gum. So the way that Nicorette uses chewing gum to deliver nicotine to the system, we use chewing gum to deliver caffeine, taurine, and B vitamins to the system. And this has a lot of, you know, great benefits because it's faster absorption. There's no calories, no sugar, no liquid. You know, TSA is going to confiscate that energy drink if you try to sneak it through as you get on the airplane. Not so with Run Gum. Similarly, you can carry a pack of Run Gum up a mountain or on a bike ride or a run with you. And because we're not paying huge dollars shipping heavy freight around the country like liquid, RTDs, ready-to-drink companies do, we are able to pass those savings on to our customers. And so a pack of Run Gum is somewhere between 25 and 33% more affordable than competitors.
I actually think what's funniest about this to me is that I didn't really realize until I tried your Run Gum actually that Red Bulls, Monsters, those types of energy drinks actually do kind of hurt my stomach or make me feel a little bit funny.
Yeah, it's a lot of sugar and it's the sugar, it's the acidity. They're very acidic drinks. The carbonation can bother you. And then a lot of it also can be the niacin. I know some of these energy drinks put niacin in. It kind of gives you that flush, hot, uncomfortable feeling. We ditched the niacin and we went with just kind of the tried and true formula of caffeine, taurine, and B vitamins.
Did either of you guys, you or Sam, have experience with developing a consumable product like this?
Absolutely zero experience bringing a consumable to market. But just like a lot of things in life, sometimes you just got to throw yourself into the deep end and you know, learn how to swim while you're there. Fortunately, Sam and I are humble enough to recognize when we know absolutely nothing about a subject or very little, and we have always been wise enough to ask for advice. So we have a great team of advisors that have helped us, and we're passionate about it. We are passionate about boosting people's performance, you know, helping people make the most of their busy days. When we launched the company, we said this can't just be about shoving more caffeine at consumers. It has to be a brand that inspires them to make the most of their busy day. So this content that we're putting out in our emails and online, it's about encouraging people to attack the goals that they've always dreamed of attacking to make the most of their busy days.
Yeah, it's much more than just, you know, here's your caffeine fix for the day. It's kind of like a whole package you're trying to put together.
Exactly.
Going back to kind of the earlier days, how did you, because I know people in our audience here today are going to be wondering this, how did you go about sourcing, you know, people or companies to help with the formulation process? Because I'm guessing this is pretty much a foreign language for just about everyone.
Well, like any good entrepreneur, it started in my garage. And, you know, I'm mushing up, chewed up pieces of gum and powders. And of course, those turned out horrible. And then I was like, at some point, it's going to be a lot easier to just get somebody else to formulate this. So I found a contract manufacturer that had, you know, formulation capabilities, a lab. And I said, hey, I want a piece of chewing gum with 50 milligrams of caffeine, taurine, and B vitamins. Can you do it? And, you know, he kind of shrugged his shoulders and he said, yeah, how many pieces do you want? So then you get into minimum order quantities. And the way, once we had a product we liked that chewed well, tasted good, and performed optimally, then it was a matter of, okay, how much do we want to go to market with? We were going to launch as a direct-to-consumer company via a Shopify website. And as ever the hopeful entrepreneur, I'm like, we need to buy millions and millions. We're going to sell out instantly. And so I think we bought a million pieces of this stuff and packaged it up. Yeah. I mean, do you know how scary it is to write a check for a million pieces of chewing gum and have it shipped across the country without even a warehouse to put it in? We were scrambling to find a warehouse while it was on the back of a truck on the way to our warehouse. So like,
it was more than could fit in your garage, I guess.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was 36 pallets worth of gum. And I'm like, guys, we need more gum. This is going to sell so quickly. It took us 2 years to go through that. But, but you know, I'm glad we had it because...
Good lesson learned.
Exactly. Like, it maybe wasn't the smartest thing from a cash flow standpoint, but what it did was it gave us enough inventory that we didn't really have to worry about supply chain for those first 2 years. We just worried about developing a great relationship with our customers, building out an email database, building out our social profiles. We really focused on marketing and PR and just, you know, order fulfillment was really a no-brainer. We had one employee initially that handled order fulfillment and website management. So it was really simple. It taught us to run lean. It taught us every single angle of our business. And it preserved equity for us ultimately. We didn't raise money until we were 3+ years in business. So we were able to preserve a lot of equity by doing it that way as well.
Do you remember who your very first customer was that wasn't a friend or family member?
That's a great question. We like I said, we launched as a direct-to-consumer company. So there were hundreds of orders that first day from a lot of people because I had a pretty substantial social following by that point as a two-time Olympian. So a lot of my followers were buying it from us. But the first big order I remember, there's a local running company in town called Eugene Running Company. And they said, hey, we'll carry your product just because we love you here in the community. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe a brick and mortar store is going to carry our product. And so I went and sold them a case, you know, which was about 24 boxes at the time. And it was this huge order, like $200-some. And I laugh at because today we're in over about 15,000 stores, you know, including CVS and Target and REI. And so we've come so far in just such a short amount of time. God, I love entrepreneurial business. You know, I wake up every day and I check my email. And on any given day in that inbox, there could be an email from a buyer or from a venture capitalist or something that will change my life forever. And I just love that sense of uncertainty each day.
Yeah, I like that it's exciting for you. And so my next question was actually going to be about this CVS deal because I just saw that this was relatively recent for you, right?
Yeah, it's something that we have been working on for a while. When you see a company launch nationwide with a big chain, that's probably been 6 to 12 to 18 months in the works. And CVS actually came relatively quickly. We went nationwide with Target last year and had such great performance data from how we were doing there that it was pretty easy to get the meeting with CVS and get them to commit. And we were actually announcing another major retailer at the end of this year. But we try to stagger our big relationships every 6 months so as not to dilute, you know, our power to drive traffic. So right now we're nationwide in CVS. You can find us in the memory and focus section. And we are just honored to be working with CVS. They have 9,600 stores nationwide. So you know, within a couple mile walk or drive from most Americans, you can find a CVS.
That's wild. Yeah. So kind of like zooming in on, you know, whether it's CVS or Target, one of your other major retail partners, whichever one you want to kind of like focus on for a second, how do you make the types of connections at these companies? Do you already have to have a successful product in order to like get on their radar? Did you cold email someone? What did that look like for you?
you know, if you have a successful product and you have great sales data, it makes it a lot easier. But you usually have to crawl before you walk, and you have to walk before you run. And so we started with, you know, running specialty, which we had street cred in the running community. We knew we'd be successful there. We took that sales data to go get, you know, Vitamin Shoppe and REI. And then we took that sales data to go get Target. And then Target, of course, is the big domino that knocks the other dominoes down. That said, you know, I don't know how to walk into Target HQ and negotiate that deal. So we do use brokers for the big accounts. And these brokers represent many, many customers like Run Gum, but they know how to walk the walk and talk the talk when it comes to the buyers at the big brick and mortar. So they take a commission of what they, of the ultimate sale, sure. of the ultimate PO, but they are absolutely critical in making sure that these deals get done right.
Yeah. It's very worth the investment on those ones.
I agree. Yep.
So talking numbers now, about how much revenue would you say Run Gum generates on a, you know, monthly, yearly basis, even just a ballpark figure, if that's
it? Yeah. I there was a time when we were predominantly a direct-to-consumer company where I could give you a month-to-month forecast, you know, that would be really pretty accurate. Then you start getting these big brick-and-mortar stores, and we call it lumpy, right? We might have one month where we're doing 50 grand, and we might have another month where we're doing 250 grand. So it's all over the place, but if I was to, you know, project our annual revenue for this year, I think 2 million is probably pretty accurate. And that would represent 3x growth of what we were able to do last year. So I think we were just north of $750,000 last year in gross revenue, and we're on track to top 2 million this year. So that would in CPG, that's fast growth. You know, if you can 3x your revenue year over year, you know, you're kind of the belle of the ball when you're talking to investors. And I do believe with the right fundraising strategy, we can continue that growth trajectory.
Yeah, that's a really nice trend line. What would you say has been your biggest growth channel over the past couple of years? Is it now this kind of like retail focus, or are you guys doing mostly direct to your own consumers online?
We love our direct to consumer business because it's more of an intimate relationship. You know, like we have a subscription side to our business where you can have Run Gum shipped to your doorstep, you know, on a repeating cycle. And we add free gifts into those shipments and a personal note from me to them every month. And so it's this really like you're building this group of consumers that really love who you are as a company. And so I love that angle. And we put a lot of money towards that because we just believe in it and it's so powerful. And that's growing very quickly. But if you were to look at just the, you know, gross revenue driver, it is coming from our wholesale business. And we made a conscious decision to switch from a mostly direct-to-consumer business to a business-to-business wholesale model when we realized that to have that 3x growth in this particular, you know, sector of CPG, we were going to have that distribution built out. And so it was a pain point for us last year as we made that transition. You're looking at, you know, increased equipment. We couldn't keep up with demand, so we had to spend $70,000 on a new machine to make more gum. You're looking at net 90 terms. So now instead of getting paid immediately when someone buys from RunGum.com, you know, Target, CVS, they pay net 90. So we ship the gum and then we kind of twiddle our thumbs, wait 90 days for that check to come in. That's a huge, huge constraint, an obstacle for a young, fast-growing business. But we're learning along the way. Again, we have great advisors. We have great investors backing us. And so we felt it was time to take that step. And thank goodness we did, because now we're seeing that, you know, exponential growth that we were always hoping to achieve.
I love it. We're expecting big things. All right. Well, Nick, the last question I had for you today, what would you say is your number one piece of advice to our audience listening that wants to build a profitable product-driven business of their own?
Oh man, what a great question. I think, well, let's talk the side hustle, right? Because so many people have so many things going on. When I started Run Gum, I wasn't this, you know, starving kid that was like, I need to make money, so I'm going to go and start a business. It was a side hustle. Run Gum was born as a side hustle. I was making great money as a pro runner, but I knew that you talk about, you know, diversifying your income streams. Most millionaires have at least seven different income streams. And I recognized that. So I had real estate rentals. Mm-hmm. I had my running income. I had stocks. And I said, how am I going to continue to build out income streams? And more importantly, have a sense of purpose when I retire. And that's kind of what Run Gum was born from. I said, I want to have something that has very high ceiling that gives me a sense of purpose and gives me this, you know, room for exponential growth and income. And so that's what Run Gum was born from. So most people out there, you're going to start your business as a side hustle. Do your due diligence, you know, collect your data, and remember, it doesn't have to be your primary focus from day one, and it certainly does not have to be perfect from day one. If you go back and look at what Run Gum looked like when we launched, or the iterations that have allowed us to progress to where we are today, building a business is a constant state of evolution. And I guarantee that first product, whatever it's going to be, you're going to look back on it one day and say, that was a real turd. But that's okay. Turds sell. You know, I'm learning that today. I started a side hustle, which is a YouTube channel. And it was really more about connecting with my fans and giving back to them some of the knowledge that I've collected as a runner and as an entrepreneur. And so I started this little side hustle that was my YouTube channel, and then it started to really grow. And YouTube and Google started sending me all these checks. And I thought to myself, hey, this is a cute little side hustle, but it kind of paled in comparison to what I was doing with Run Gum and the amount of influence that I was having now with this audience. So I actually started giving that money back to the viewers. Every week I run a sweepstakes called the Simmons Sweepstakes that gives that ad revenue back. So again, you don't know where a side hustle is going to take you. Sometimes it'll create a multi-million or even a billion-dollar business, and sometimes it just creates something that could be a hobby or a pet project. But I think there's something so rewarding in just exploring passion, exploring ideas, and there's no better indicator of your idea than the market. The market will ultimately dictate the success of any great idea.
That is great advice. All right. Well, Nick, thank you again for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening today where they can go to learn more about you, Run Gum, and everything else you're up to?
Run Gum is across all platforms at Run Gum, and you can find it if you want to subscribe and save, of course, rungum.com. We're on Amazon, we're in Target, we're in CVS, etc. I personally love social media. I'm really active on Instagram, and as I mentioned, YouTube. Those are kind of the driving forces on my social platforms. And I love interacting with my fans, whether it's from a business standpoint or an athletic standpoint. I try to get back to every single question DM'd to me over on Instagram. And I do feel this debt to repay the knowledge that's been given to me from our advisors, from investors, from my coaches. You know, I at 35, I've been doing this for a little while. I've got some nuggets up there that I love to pass on to aspiring entrepreneurs and aspiring Olympians.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Nick, thanks you.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.